Brexit podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hemming, and you might have noticed that I've been doing a few more of the introductions of late. That's because my lovely co-host, Jennifer Han, is actually out in Thailand at the moment doing some kickboxing. She's right up her street. She wasn't at all scared before she left, but that's left me rolling with the punches this end. So I'm covering all things Brexit. And on Brexit, what the hell happens next? Not just a question that we want to cover in pretty much every episode of this podcast, but also the title of Ian Dunn's book. Ian Dunn is the editor of politics.co.uk, and he's also the guest on the show today. Ian's probably one of the most knowledgeable people I've spoken to on British, European and world politics, and he takes us through many areas, including his fears for the breakup of the United Kingdom. So stay tuned for this one. I think there's some really interesting stuff, particularly in terms of tariff rates that I didn't know a huge amount about, but I've certainly been more educated after speaking to Ian. And if you have some comments to make, we'd love to hear from you. As always, you can get in touch with us on Facebook, you can get in touch with us on Twitter, or you can go to the website brexitpodcast.com, where you can leave comments after the individual episodes. So I look forward to hearing from you soon. Oh, just one more thing, we'd love to have some more people from the Leave side of the debate, so if you have any suggestions, then please get in touch. But until then, enjoy the show. And welcome to the Brexit podcast, Ian Dunn.
Hello.
Hey. Thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it. Now, I just dived onto Amazon and I was looking at a review of your book. And one of the commentators said, it's scary to realise, as one quickly does, that anyone who's read Ian Dunn's book is likely to have a much better grasp of Brexit than any of our current Brexit ministers. So you wrote the book, Brexit, What the Hell Happens Now? So Ian, what the hell does happen now?
God knows. And to be honest, I have to put a note of caution on that. I think that's true for Boris and Fox. I think that David Davis is a much smarter bloke than that. I'm horrified by the decisions he's made and his lack of judgment and his decision to surround himself in echo chambers. But I have to say, the more people you speak to, you know, anyone who's trying to lobby aims for his department and tries to avoid anything else because they know they have a better chance of being listened to there than they do elsewhere. They still have a hard time of it there. But I think he has you can see in that pained expression he has now a sense of the breadth and the depth of the problem that he faces. And in fact, I think that's resembled a bit in his posture. So he probably does have some idea of what he's doing, but he's trapped into a course over which he has very little control.
But is your confidence in him being eroded?
Oh, I have almost no confidence in him at all. I just mean that, you know, you do get the sense that even though his judgment is wrong, he does understand the extent of what is about to happen. Unlike, I think, Boris and Fox, who have pretty much gotten off the leash and just get to swan around pretending everything will be fine.
Yeah, you wrote an interesting piece actually on the website, which is, I'm not sure if you authored it, but it says, if Liam Fox messes up, we're in deep trouble or serious trouble.
Yeah.
And it's to do with tariff rate quotas. Can you just explain a little bit about that for us,
please? Yeah. Oh, you poor people. Yeah. Okay. So, when you're looking at the WTO schedules, WTO schedules are basically menus that describe your country's trading arrangements with the rest of the world. You have one for goods, you have one for services. And what Liam Fox's department, this is his department, this is his work, this is not really to do with Brexit, this is to do with preparing the ground at the WTO for us to be able to go there. What you can mostly do is just copy and paste it. So let's say it's your tariffs, let's say it's 8% on oranges, which I don't think it is, by the way, but let's just say it is. Then you can say, well, fine, you know, the EU has 8% on oranges, the UK is also going to have 8% on oranges, we will just copy all the tariffs. And that works for everything apart from tariff rate quotas. And the difference here is that they're quantitative. So a tariff rate quota works like this. Say if you have, so Thailand sends an awful lot of poultry to Europe and the UK, hundreds of thousands of tons of it, a huge amount of it. And you would say, look, for the first 40,000 tons, the tariff is 2%. And for any amount over that, the tariff comes in at 8%. So you split the tariff rate depending on how much has come to the European continent. Now, the problem is you can't just copy that tariff rate over like you can the others. If you remove Britain from the EU, you have to try and figure out how much of that chicken is coming to Britain.
So we could be swamped with cheap poultry.
Well, it can go sort of either way. I mean, your main problem isn't really where you end up. The main problem is, do they accept the number that you give them? What Britain is going to do, what Liam Fox's department will, I mean, he hasn't announced this, but I would be shocked if he picked any other strategy. He will basically take the last 3 or 4 years trade flow and say, take the average of that and say, well, that's how much of the chicken it is that Britain gets. So our share of the tariff rate quota is this much. Now, you can put that in front of Thailand or any other country, you know, that's sending us stuff, New Zealand with lamb or Brazil with this, and say, well, look, do you accept this number? The question then is, what is the incentive on those guys? If it's a number that's quite low, then they might still not accept it because they might think, well, look, here's a vulnerable trading partner. We've got an ability to open up market access. We can get in there. If it's a number that they don't approve of, they're definitely not going to accept it. So either way, they're incentivized to launch a trade dispute against us at the WTO. Now, the scary part is anyone that exports to us can do this. Anybody at all. So suddenly when we say, oh, look, it's fine, we'll just drop onto WTO trade rules. Well, actually, it's not as simple as that. We can start trading on those arrangements, but it's very possible that we would end up in a series of protracted and quite brutal trade disputes with all of our trading partners, not the least of whom is the European Union itself, which operates as an independent actor of the WTO and may well be the first in line to initiate those disputes.
Very well explained. Are the WTO, if we go on to WTO rates, are they as bad as it's constantly made out?
Well, it's not really.
It's
not so much the WTO that's the problem, although it's not great. The problem is the absence of anything else. No one just relies on the WTO. Everybody else has at least trading arrangements with other major blocs like the US or China or the EU. I mean, there's no major economy which has zero trading arrangements with the EU, not one. The EU's not been fantastic at sorting out full fat comprehensive trade deals. It's got one with South Korea, it's got one with Canada that it just sorted out. However, it's much better at organizing these trading arrangements. So these are the things that are basically called non-tariff barriers and trying to get rid of them. So you say, look, we've got these health and safety standards, let's say sort of toxicity in the substances used to make toys or let's say how much the electromagnetic sort of stuff going on inside of a car radio player would interfere with someone's sort of artificial heart or something like that. They have those standards in the EU. Now, you have another set of products being made in China. Your mutual recognition is basically to say, look, that the EU recognizes that the Chinese authorities can stamp those products to say that they are up to the standards that the EU sets. Now, that actually saves you an awful lot of work because it means that goods don't get stopped at the border to be tested by customs officials. You don't get tailbacks of shipping. You don't get tailbacks of lorries at borders. You basically just have a system whereby you trust each other's authorities. You stamp it and over it can come. Now, that takes a long time to build up that kind of trust. And it takes an awful lot of legislative work and regulatory work. And you've got to train up a lot of people in your domestic economy to do that work in order to be able to deliver at the pace which trading requires. Now, at the moment, Britain has none of those things set up because we've been inside of the EU. We need time to do all of this. And the kind of timetable that we're looking at is simply will not offer it to us. So the problem of dropping out onto the WTO in 2 years isn't that the WTO is so bad. It's that we lose all of this complex network of regulatory recognition and a political recognition which allows for a smooth flowing trading network. And without it, that will have a very, very severe effect on the British economy indeed and would lose, some of the American business groups looking at us are expecting us to lose well over 1 million jobs if that's the way that it goes.
Now, Theresa May is expected to trigger Article 50 fairly imminently, which kicks off this two-year period. But that's not long enough, is it?
To negotiate a comprehensive trade deal, it's not even a beginning to be enough. And that's not even all that she has to do. I mean, she basically has three tasks. So the first one is divorce. And the divorce is about the budget, and that is probably going to be a more brutal conversation than we originally anticipated, and the status of EU citizens in Britain and British citizens in the EU. That's the divorce. That's the sort of sharing out the cutlery and saying who owns which records. Then there is the trade deal about the future, and then there is the transitional deal that we need to get us from this period to there while still making sure that we're still part of all those trading arrangements that I just described. She might have time to do the divorce deal. I mean, even that is pushing it. At best, she'll be able to do that and organize the transitional deal and might get a one side of A4 piece of paper saying, well, look, we all want frictionless trade. We all want no tariffs. And we're going to try to come up with a comprehensive trade agreement by the end of 2025 or something like that. That would be a realistic timetable. Although even then, by the way, there's an awful lot of trade experts that don't think it can be done to that timetable.
Certainly,
she can't do the full deal in 2 years. I haven't heard anyone at all that understands these issues say that that was possible.
Brexiteers must be not particularly happy about that, though, and saying Brexit means Brexit and we must head out as soon as possible.
The funny part is that there's two... You're right, I mean, that is exactly what they say, but there's two things here. I mean, one of them is your final point, and the other one is how you get there. And there's been a conflation, because, I mean, to say that we're going to have, you know, a deal and move out, but we need a realistic timetable, doesn't mean that you're not Brexiting. I mean, you are Brexiting. You're just doing it in a realistic, sober timetable. When these things got conflated is when it went from something which I found politically unfortunate to something that was actually potentially catastrophic on a basic level of national interest, rather than whether you happen to agree with Brexit or not. And that, you know, this idea, this sort of hysterical, highly emotional debate that's taken over, where people seem to behave as if they have this sort of sense of democratic mission, and they tend to treat criticism or the pointing out of problems as an act of treason. And that sort of, you know, I'm perhaps slightly exaggerating, but certainly enough to make them question someone's patriotism. And that has led us to a very, very strange place. And the worst part is that Theresa May seems to be completely, her priority seems to be placating that part of the debate, whether it's in the press or whether it's in Parliament or whether it's UKIP outside of Parliament, and rather than actually trying to come up with a realistic way of securing her Brexit objectives. This isn't really about the objectives. This is about how you deliver them.
Yeah, and May's had her head turned in the past few days with quite a toxic sort of tete-a-tete with Nicola Sturgeon. Sturgeon's received the opportunity to push for another referendum, and just seems to add even more chaos to an already very complex situation.
Yeah, it does. You know, this was avoidable. I mean, this was avoidable from the start. May struck the right note immediately when she became prime minister, when she went to visit her and assured her that she'd be part of the process. Since then, she has frozen her out completely. She picked the most hard form of Brexit she possibly could, by saying we'd pull out of the single market and we'd kind of pretty much pull out of the customs union, pull out of any budgetary contributions, pull out of the European Court of Justice in any way whatsoever. So by then, I mean, it was already clear that she'd completely ignored any kind of moderate approach to Brexit, which would have placated Scotland's concerns and those in Northern Ireland. And also those, let's not forget, of the 48%, you know, of Remainers, who just because they lost didn't deserve to be completely and utterly ignored and disparaged in the process which followed. Then after doing that, she then refused to countenance any idea that Scotland might be able to carve out a role in the single market. I don't know how realistic that was, by the way, but Theresa May could have at least paid it some respect, or looked like she was, in order to keep Nicola Sturgeon on side. Even failing on those two fronts, she could have used a little bit of carrot and stick with the process of devolving powers from Brussels down to Holyrood. As it is, we would expect Holyrood to be given powers over agriculture and fisheries. Now, Westminster is quite concerned about this, and for pretty good reasons. We're used to having one level, one set of standards, one set of regulatory and non-regulatory standards for the way that agriculture is done in Britain. It's a huge change for us to think that suddenly Scotland will be doing, you know, say, have completely different regulations over animal welfare or pesticides or something. And it would potentially allow Scotland to undercut England, or perhaps to go, you know, much higher up in standards than England. And all of that was quite strange. So Theresa May could have offered placatory sounds about this. She could have said, look, I'm not planning on intervening, but, you know, better stick over here. But, you know, if you keep on making trouble, I could possibly move to block that and blah, blah. Instead, she almost said, you know, during PMQs to Angus Robertson the other day, look, I'm probably going to block this. And she's failed to give Scotland any powerful role in the Great Repeal Bill process, as basically about half a century of British law is tossed around in Westminster. If she'd offered Scotland some kind of beefed up role in that process, it's possible she could have got them off her back. And so she did none of these things. She just beat Scotland with a stick over and over and over again. And now, lo and behold, here we are. Nicola Sturgeon saying she wants a referendum before Britain Brexit. Now, regardless of what happens there, just in terms of the Article 50 process, that makes it very, very difficult indeed for for Theresa May. Because anything she's saying to a European partner, the European partner can just turn around and go, well, fine, if you want to stick to that position, I'll just go hold a press conference with Nicola Sturgeon talking about fast-track membership and how everything's going to be fine. So it's not only a problem in terms of the union breaking up, but also this is something that massively complicates what she's doing at Article 50. And I have to say, this is kind of par for the course for a prime minister who makes several unforced errors and strategic blunders, which she simply does not need to make, and yet continues to make them on an almost daily basis.
This, I guess Theresa May would argue that she's trying to hold the whole thing together. We, as a Great Britain, voted to leave Europe, and so she's just trying to keep us all stuck in one pot. You know, that was the sort of democratic decision of the people.
Well, I mean, Sturgeon isn't really questioning the EU part. If you watch her speech, she's mostly just talking about the single market. And there is no mandate for leaving the single market. It wasn't on the ballot paper. When you look at the polling around that period and immediately after it, there wasn't any public demand for leaving the single market. Most polls show that about 20 to 40% of people, of leavers, thought that we should either stay in the single market or that they wouldn't be willing to pay any economic price or pay any economic risk for reducing immigration. So that sort of idea that this hard Brexit is the only possible form of Brexit that was available, I don't think stands up. And anyway, doesn't seem a sensible way to proceed when you've got such a tight vote and when two of the constituent nations of the UK didn't support it, not to mention places like Gibraltar. So I just don't know if she is sort of keeping everything together. I think that the manner in which she proceeded was exactly what you would do if you want to put the union at risk. And indeed has provided some of the most, you know, magnificent material for the Scottish National Party to use when they want to make their case that London routinely ignores Scotland.
Yeah, and if Westminster's ignoring Scotland, do you feel that they're also ignoring Northern Ireland currently?
Yes, indeed, yeah. I mean, it's really quite instructive to look at David Davis in front of the Brexit Committee on, I think it was Tuesday. It may have been Wednesday. He's asked questions about Northern Ireland during that session, where he just keeps on saying, well, look, I don't really know the answer, I have to go check. And Northern Ireland MPs on the committee are just aghast. And so they're like, how can this, you know, we've been telling you about this for months, how can you still not understand these issues? And it's inevitably the case that when, you know, over last weekend, Boris Johnson, Liam Fox, David Davis came out to do this big, look, it will be fine if there's no deal. It'll be perfectly okay. Perfectly okay is the Boris Johnson quote. Look, if you're an island, that is not perfectly okay. If there's no deal, it means we have to throw up customs checkpoints at the border. And for many people who cross that border every day, sometimes multiple times a day, that would be very, very dramatically bad. It would also be very bad if you're someone who doesn't want to return to violence in Northern Ireland, because you're perpetuating a sense of division in a place that has only just gotten over that very sense of division and the very existence of that border being a cause for massive political volatility and possible aggression. Now, that was if the border even worked. And yet, right now, they can't start setting up that border agency because we don't know that it will be required. We can't start hiring the people to work on it because we don't know that they'll be required. We can't start training them up or putting in place the systems by which it would work or installing the technology that would be required for it to function. So we have to wait until there's no deal. But the day after there's no deal, that customs border needs to be there, and Europe will demand that it is there. So at the moment, we're risking having to create something which we do not have the time or the capacity or the interest in doing in order to make up for a negotiating strategy, which would see us leaving when it's not something that we want to do from the customs union and the single market. This is a very, very dangerous period that we're entering into, and you get a sense that ministers are doing it without a full appreciation of the repercussions of their actions.
Is there any positive noises coming out of Westminster in terms of Belfast?
No, I can't think of any.
Oh, okay. So this.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, so
I'm trying to tell you something more upbeat, but I.
So other people of Northern Ireland kind of start to feel so disaffected that there becomes a drive for reunification of Ireland.
Oh, that's already happening. I mean, that's being talked about in the press over there all the time. And then there's also a demographic sort of dynamic towards that, that actually in enough time that the numbers are there. And the Good Friday Agreement, the way it's written, it sort of puts Northern Ireland in an anteroom. At any moment that people say that there's enough support for a reunified Ireland in order to hold a referendum, they have the right to do so. That's the consent principle. So, yeah, it has to be said.
Does that just mean there's enough support for Sinn Féin? Would that be the key marker?
Well, it doesn't have to be Sinn Féin, really. I mean, it's a slightly more sort of fractured dynamic there. I accept that that's the standard vehicle, but it doesn't have to be that. And I suspect that actually, to the extent which it doesn't have to be through Sinn Féin, would bolster its ability to succeed and would get rid of some of the toxicity around it. I honestly think it's quite hard, and I say this as a unionist and a proud British patriot, it's hard to look at the situation right now and not think we are witnessing the beginning of the end of the union. I mean, in terms of Scotland and Northern Ireland, and then, I know that not many people in Wales talk about it, but I think once that happens, that debate in Wales takes off.
Let's try and make things a little bit more positive. I won't keep you too much longer. There's a lot of elections happening in Europe at the moment. We're buoyed by the elections in the Netherlands the other day with Mark Rutte's centre-right People's Party coming out on top.
Yes, indeed. That's very, very good news. And combined with the result that we saw in Austria, I mean, I was talking to some Austrian journalists when they had their presidential sort of runoff and an actual bona fide fascist was really in the running. And they were telling me about, some areas of Austria. These are conservative areas of Austria that were voting for the Green Party in order to stop him. And they were quite impressed and struck by this. It felt like there was a sense among lots of centrist people, people on the center right, that there was a danger here that had to be faced up to and addressed, the danger of sort of, authoritarian nationalism, even white nationalism. And I think it looks like we may have seen the same thing in Holland with a very high turnout, absolutely swamping Wilders' ability to appeal to people. I think you might be able to see a similar trend happening with the startling rise of Scholz in Germany. You could possibly say the same thing about Macron in France. It's too early for us to relax about this, but it is true that what's happened in Austria and what happened in the Netherlands are very, very positive signs that the trend that some of us had imagined, begun with Brexit, continued with Trump, won't necessarily swamp all of the West.
Because Wilders did pick up 4 extra seats, so he did claim that his position has been strengthened.
I mean, it's not as if he did badly. And also, we shouldn't ignore the fact that the election campaign was run in really quite toxic, anti-immigration, right-wing language from the centre-right. That was sort of incorporated into the centre-right party. So it's not as if suddenly, Holland turned around and was, made a beautiful expression of multicultural liberalism or anything like that. But we've seen, one of the big cheerleaders, one of Farage's favourites, one of the great ringleaders for sort of authoritarian nationalism being brought to heel and not making the kind of success that he was expecting. The polling is looking very good in France. It's possible that things have turned the corner, but there's nowhere near enough there for us to be complacent about it.
The thing is, though, with so many people voting for sort of right-wing parties, not everybody can be racist or stupid, as one of our last guests on the podcast said, and we got some criticism for that, probably rightly, for not challenging them. So, I mean, you must have some empathy at times for people. People scared, or what's your thoughts? Why is there this drive towards nationalism?
So you're completely right, and
it's
not
a
big everybody.
Question.
Yeah, it is a big question. I'll try and answer it in a minute at least. So the solution has to be that centrists and left wingers retain the confidence to talk about economics in a way that isn't just about supporting the status quo. We gave up on that, I think, during Thatcher, in this country, during Thatcherism, in the US, during Reaganism, And that coincided with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And this sense, this historic, you know, the Fukuyama, so, you know, this historic sense of like, well, that's just game over for any economic conversation. It's the free market. And then you get people like Blair coming in and go, look, we won't mess with the free market. We'll just divert a bit of the money over to welfare programs and schools. And that's our third way. And that is not a very satisfying message for people right now. When Clinton ran on what was ultimately a status quo message, she was defeated. And I think the defeat is not about the politics of it. The defeat is about, do you look like someone who is prepared to take on the system and improve people's lives? Macron in France, I know it's always dangerous to compare countries in this way, and I don't want to be too simplistic about it, but he is running on a centrist system. But the message is, I'm going to kick the hell out of it. And so that tone, that idea that there is a radicalism in the center and in liberalism and on the left that can improve people's lives and that isn't just going to meekly sit there and accept what the market does, that is the answer to this. The answer is not, as some right-wing Labour MPs seem to think, to suddenly start sort of echoing the anti-immigration rhetoric of the far right or of UKIP in a bid to sort of, you know, act as if you're on side. That is not the solution. The solution has to be about economic policies and about making it clear to people that you can improve their lives. And until the left starts doing that, we're still going to be subject to these kind of dangerous political forces.
Ian, thanks ever so much for coming on today. Just stepping forward now, what's the next things to look out for? Theresa May triggering Article 50, and what else is on the horizon for us?
I have to tell you, it's hard to say now that we're in the Article 50 business, because Europe, the first battle, I suppose, before anything else, is how do talks proceed, and rather than the substance of them. Britain will want two things from those talks. It will want to de-sequence them so that we talk about everything all together, future trading relationships, the budget, the EU citizens over here, the interim stuff. Europe will want them in sequence because the longer the talks go on for without a deal on the future arrangement, the more powerful its position is. So it will want them done one by one by one. The other part that Britain will want is it will want to sort of cut up the levels at which talks operate. It will want a high-level political talk, and below that, it will want customs officials to be chatting with one another from Europe to Britain in order to recognize their arrangement so that they can already informally, sort of organically, create a network of recognition that's in place for when things end. Europe probably won't want to allow that because, again, it weakens its position. So the first thing to look out for, I think, is the battles over the form of talks rather than the content of talks. And that'll give us some indication of the kind of dynamics that will be at play for the rest of the Article 50 process.
Excellent. And is your book still relevant, or is it all changed now since you wrote it?
It is still relevant. Actually, I have to say I'm feeling quite happy with how much of it has survived. And partly that's my editor, who was clever enough to take out the bits that wouldn't. So, for instance, I sort of ignored all of the Article 50 court case stuff, even though I'd written a lot about it. He just removed that whole chapter and just said, look, this is going to date much faster than you realize. And he was entirely correct in doing that. I think if there's anything that's out of date, it's only now with the Nicola Sturgeon stuff on the referendum, because she's now actually announced that they're going to try and hold one. And that's not a possibility anymore. In terms of the central dynamics, in terms of the actual content of that book, everything is still relevant. And I think we'll probably survive for about, you know, sort of 3-4 months into Article 50 before it starts looking dated.
Okay. So where should people go to pick up a copy?
Oh, go to Amazon. Yeah. I mean, everybody knows Amazon, don't they? Yeah.
They do. They do. Ian, thanks ever so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time. That's all for today, folks. The show's been brought to you by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Pohl, and the theme music by Kevin MacLeod. For all things Brexit podcasts, go to brexitpodcast.com.